Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 24, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Congressional Review Act and the Administrative Procedure Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guests to our call this afternoon, the Honorable David M. McIntosh. He's the President of the Club for Growth and Vice Chairman of the Federalist Society. He'll be joined by Todd F. Gaziano. He's a Senior Fellow in Constitutional Law and the Executive Director of the Pacific Legal Foundation's D.C. Center right here in Washington. We're going to get opening remarks from each of about 10 to 15 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. With that, David McIntosh, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. It's great to be back on the phone with you and everybody at the Federalist Society. Today, we want to talk about a bill that I had worked on when I was in Congress 20-some years ago called the Congressional Review Act, which created a tool for Congress to begin reviewing regulations and disapproving them when they disagreed with the agencies. It was originally written by Don Nichols and me, and Newt and the Senate leadership put it into the Contract with America, and eventually was tucked into the debt ceiling that President Clinton signed in 1996. Surprised everybody, hadn't really been used because the difficulty is when the president agrees with the agency, he can veto the bill that Congress passes overruling the regulatory agency. And so it has very little practical effect except in instances like today where you've got regulations from the Obama administration that are still subject to the Congressional Review Act and the timetables. And a new president, President Trump, who is willing to reverse course and scale back those regulations. The key is there's a 60-day look back, and that's 60 legislative days, so effectively about 6 months back into the Obama administration. And Congress has expedited procedures in both the House and, most importantly, in the Senate, where you can avoid a filibuster with a 50-vote requirement to pass the Congressional Review Act resolution. We've seen two of them passed already by both the Senate and the House, and an additional 11 that were passed by the House waiting for consideration in the Senate. The good friend of mine at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Clyde Wayne Cruz, has analyzed all the different regulations that have been promulgated in that 6 months. And there's a list of about 230 that would have a significant impact. Another review I saw showed an even smaller list than that. You could save $60 billion a year in cost to the economy by repealing several dozen of these Obama regulations. So the impact is real and immediate and a tremendous benefit for economic growth as they do that. The couple of other things that Todd Gaziano, who's joined us and going to speak after me, is the expert on this. My subcommittee wrote the bill and put it forward, so I take credit for it, like everybody in Washington does. But it was really Todd and his great legal work and the committee staff who negotiated the provisions of the bill and knows and the legislative history. And so he's looked at the Congressional Review Act and pointed out there even greater potential for the use by Congress and the Trump administration in scaling back these unnecessary and unwanted regulations. I would, before I turn it over to Todd, mention that in general, I think this is part of a larger context. The president has stated a goal of reducing two regulations for every one new regulation that his administrative agencies promulgate. A very laudable goal. Something like that was done in England. It was one for one and had a tremendous effect under the Conservative government several years back. and in addition, the general direction to reduce the burden of regulatory costs on American economy by 75%, which is an audacious goal. Tremendous that he set that out there and that the agencies are working towards it. And by the way, the latest estimate of the cost of all federal regulations is about $2 trillion in lost productivity and higher prices. So a 75% reduction there would be a tremendous impact on the GDP of the country and our ability to be competitive around the world. I think one thing to note is there are also some additional legislative fixes for the Congressional Review Act that would make it operative and effective at all times. And the best one that I've seen is the RAINS Act that essentially flips the presumption to say that before major rules can go into effect, Congress will have to pass legislation approving them. I think that change would mean that Congress once again was held accountable for these regulations that stem from legislation they've passed, and would put an additional check on these agencies in the democratic process, where these rules that are often written in the vacuum for most Americans suddenly start impacting their business and their livelihood. So I'm urging Congress to move forward on that while they're at the same time starting to use the Congressional Review Act, because in a few months that timeliness will have dissipated, and the rules that will be coming out then will be from the Trump administration, and it'll be unlikely that there would be ones that the president would sign a bill reversing them. So I'm excited to do this and work on this project. The Club for Growth has supported the resolutions that Congress is working on, and we think it's a tremendous bottom line positive impact for economic growth. With that, Dean, I turn it back or turn it over to you, Todd.
Well, I can certainly take over for here, and as I did in an earlier program that David and I were on, I'll begin with my thanks, except I'm going to tell one or two more stories on David, but first my thanks for the extraordinary opportunity I had to work with him, and the way in which David operated, he, you know, gave me a lot of praise today. Unlike when you're a law clerk working for a judge, you never want to discuss any of the cases or opinions you helped work on. But David always was gracious in giving us credit and encouraging us to talk and fight for further reform. And as I said earlier in the week, that's because he's a great person. But it's also because he, like Reagan, didn't care who got all of the credit. He just wanted us to be more effective for liberty. So one of the my outline for today is to talk about the CRA in three iterations. And this is my organization and that of a new website that Pacific Legal Foundation has launched this week. And so CRA 1.0 is its sort of intended traditional use. And we are so excited, as I think everyone is excited, about how the President Trump has already killed more rules and enacted more laws under it than all previous presidents combined, and that's when it was two. But I think within the next few months, he's probably going to sign as many as 12 or 14 or I would hope many, many more than that. So that's CRA 1.0. I'll then talk about CRA 2.0, which Kimberly Strassel wrote up based on a presentation I gave at a working group in town. And that's a way to use it to reach back 21 years to rules that were never delivered to Congress in violation of the law. So that wasn't the intended purpose of the law, but it's a consequence of the agency's failure to follow it. And then what I call CRA 3.0 is the way the administration could use it in an even more supercharged manner. So back to CRA 1.0. David, of course, provided the outlines of it, but a few other features that he fought for, and I was able to help with the drafting, as he said, on the including the legislative history, but his comments on the floor of the House when this was passed are the most important legislative history statements on it. And one, of course, included an additional feature that I don't think David mentioned, which is that if Congress ever uses this law, the expedited procedures without a filibuster, to kill a regulation, there's a provision in the law that says the agencies are then forbidden, essentially to circumvent the rule revocation, by ever issuing a substantially similar rule ever again without subsequent congressional authorization. Now, there hasn't been any court case on substantially similar because there was only one rule before, the ergonomics rule, that was ever killed before this year. And apparently no agency tried to reissue a substantially similar rule. But I think that will be a very interesting issue in the future. I saw one Washington Post article similar to a Politico article, and listeners on this call will be very amused. Only in the Beltway news media will they give voice to the whines and complaints of this bureaucrat. And here was his basic argument. He said, "I worked on this rule for 7 years, and it's undemocratic for our people's representatives in the House and Senate to separately, a majority of them, to overrule it, and for the president to get rid of my work." And then he lamented at the end that not only was this undemocratic, which was an earlier quote, but that people will be injured. You know, what we can learn from that is that, of course, he and the Washington media, and well, just mainstream thought in general, have inverted the protections for separation of powers for liberty in the Constitution. And secondly, I found his quote just fabulous, that he thought it was undemocratic. Raines Act is only an attempt to get around the excessive delegations, and even Raines Act itself would not in the least be undemocratic, quite the opposite. But the final quote that I didn't mention yet is that he said that he would just have to work around this law to, you know, implying that this bureaucrat wants to rewrite a similar rule. So that there will be some future litigation over that, and I'm one of the things I saw rereading the legislative history that the two sponsors put in, the House and Senate sponsors, I should say, David McIntosh and Senator Nichols, put in identical statements in the record, was that Congress would, in their debates over a resolution of disapproval, give further meaning to what the rule is that they're why they're rejecting the rule, and what rule would be substantially similar that they would think their resolution is disapproving. That probably isn't conclusive on a subsequent administration or the courts, but it for those who listen to legislative history, that ought to have some bearing. Furthermore, I should add, my friends at Heritage, Darren Baxt and James Gattuso, wrote a paper suggesting that these fill-in-the-blank resolutions say what must go in the resolution after the resolving clause. But that suggests that congressmen can put in preambles in these. And we know that as lawyers that the courts don't always give effect or shouldn't necessarily give effect to preambulatory language like that, but that could help define what it is that Congress is rejecting when it rejects it, and would limit future rulemakings. So one last point on CRA 1.0 is that there is a misconception, at least there was, and maybe we're beyond that, in the Senate that you must allow 10 hours of debate, 5 hours each side, for each rule. That is the maximum amount of time, and the text is really pretty plain in the Senate procedures, that a simple majority can offer a motion that is non-debatable, which means it must be immediately voted on, to limit the time to anything less than 10 hours or none at all. And I think that certainly some individual rules might merit 5 hours of time each, but the Senate generally doesn't allow that much time on individual amendments to bills. And since these rules are already published, they're already well known, it's an up and down vote. Congress isn't creating something new. I would think that on certain rules that Congress, or the Senate, I should say, wouldn't need to stick to the 10 hours of debate. I understand the counterargument is that if the current majority doesn't allow the maximum amount of debate, that the minority might get angry. I'm not sure what more they could do to express their anger than the time they're using to hold up confirmation hearings under the current rules. But of course, I would defer, as we all would, to the leaders and the members of the Senate to work that out. But I would finally note that there are senators, I hear, who are willing to do late-night sessions if they're worried about floor time during the day. Votes on these resolutions of disapproval, let's say they set 2 hours of time or 1 hour of time per rule, you could debate as many as 10 with senators relieving each other throughout the night and then rolling the votes, and the next morning the Senate could come in and vote on 10 resolutions of disapproval. So you could kill many more rules. But that is perhaps even more relevant to what I'm going to say now as CRA 2.0. And that is the idea I presented that Kimberly Strassel wrote up, that noted the first sentence of the CRA provides that no rule may go into effect until it's provided to both houses of Congress and to GAO. And it's only on the second of publication or delivery to Congress that Congress's expedited procedures start to tick. So there are thousands of rules that have never been submitted to Congress. There have been various ACUS and other studies that have counted as many as 1,000 a year that were published in the Federal Register alone that weren't sent to Congress. GAO used to do a pretty good job until it gave up in 2011 of trying to harass OMB and the agencies to send these rules up. And early on in the Obama administration, OMB sent two circulars. I'm not sure exactly the form, but two reminders to the agencies that they needed to send all their rules up to Congress. That suggests to me that OMB knew that there was a vulnerability for enforcing rules that weren't set up to Congress, rightly so. And it also suggests to me that OMB realized and knew that Congress's review period doesn't start until they're actually submitted. Well, the fact of the matter is many that were published were still never sent to Congress, and many, many more that were guidance documents or policy manuals weren't sent to Congress. And that's important because, and this is part of the OMB guidance, the rule that the definition of the rules covered by the Congressional Review Act that Congress chose is very, very broad. It has a couple of exceptions, but it incorporates one of the broadest definitions from the APA that includes essentially it's any agency statement of general applicability and future effect, and you know that affects either policy or implementation, and it excluded, the CRA excludes agency statements of particular applicability and in a few other things. For example, we were recounting earlier this week that we didn't want to hold up fishing and hunting season. So fishing and hunting seasons announcements can go into effect immediately, and I think monetary policy is excluded. But it does cover independent agency rules. It covers almost every agency, so-called independent agencies, since we know in the Federalist Society that they're only independent in certain statutory senses, and they can't be constitutionally independent from the president if they exercise significant discretion under the law, as the Morrison versus Olson case so held. So there are, my colleagues and I at Pacific Legal Foundation have found dozens and dozens, we have a sort of working list of about 98 now, of guidance documents, policy manuals. In the question and answer period, I can describe a few of them. One almost doubles the scope of the Clean Water Act jurisdiction under the clean, that's at issue in the WOTUS rule, but it's separate from the WOTUS rule. The WOTUS rule was sent up to Congress. And all of these that I'm talking about were never sent to Congress. So if the Trump administration conducts the orderly review that we think it should, they should then issue a moratoria on their enforcement because they were never lawfully in effect while they decide what to do. And if they eventually decide to send some to Congress and Congress votes them down, remember, no agency can ever issue a substantially similar rule again. So let's just take the guidance document category. Of course an agency or this administration can revoke it on its own without citing the CRA as a reason, as they did just a couple days ago with the OCR's gender bathroom guidance. But at least for some of them, they may want Congress's political input, and more importantly, that would prevent, if Congress rejected it, that would prevent that would prevent any future administration from ever issuing a substantially similar guidance. As to the last thing I'll say is what I call CRA 3.0, and that is the administration deciding, at least for a certain group of these rules, that it doesn't ever want to go final. As it stands, the Congressional Review Act says they cannot go into effect until they're submitted to Congress. Well, it would be this administration's decision on hundreds. I should add that they, to make them go into effect, they may decide that there's a few thousand that they want to go into effect properly. They may have to deal with enforcement issues about pending enforcement actions, or in my view, I think they have to confess error and drop enforcement actions. It's a lot to for them to consider, but they might eventually send a bunch to Congress with the recommendation that Congress let them go into effect. That's always been the standing assumption when an agency sends up a rule to Congress. But now that this administration would be sending up rules from prior administrations, they may want to send a signal to Congress. So they would send up perhaps several hundred or thousand that they would recommend to go into effect. They would send up in an orderly fashion, maybe five or ten at a time, because they couldn't be expected to review 21 years of rules that weren't sent to Congress and expect Congress to act on them like that. And then there's a third category. And the third category includes both notice and comment rules that were published in the Federal Register, perhaps, but never finalized, and guidance documents and the type that were never even published in the Federal Register. And I think as to them, they ought to announce a moratorium on enforcement while they're considering what they're going to do. And with regard to the notice and comment rules, I think there's an interesting legal question as to whether it would be required that they go through notice and comment repeal or modify them. As lawyers on this call know, when a rule is actually finalized under notice and comment rulemaking, it is required to go through notice and comment rulemaking to repeal. I think there's a very good argument that the CRA actually is a further step under the APA. It's codified under the APA in its original language, required that it be codified in the APA. I think an argument could be made that not sending the bill up to Congress is a non-harmless error, and to read it as harmless error would render the Congressional Review Act a nullity and violate two textual provisions. And so one argument could be made that it is the equivalent of the rule being stopped at either the interagency review process, or it was intended to be published in the Federal Register and it was never published in the Federal Register, and it's and that this administration might have the option to pull back on notice and comment rules without further notice and comment. But if that is a step too far, and I think that's an interesting open question, they could certainly, as to those kind of rules that were never sent to Congress, just announce an interim a final rule that the rule is being reconsidered and begin the notice and comment procedure to either repeal or modify it. That, to me, would be consistent with the more generous reading of the APA requirements, but also give effect to the fact that it was never sent up to Congress. But the greatest category of significant rules that weren't sent to Congress, I believe, from my early research, and we've asked some other allies to join us in reviewing such rules, will be the major guidance documents, policy manuals, and the like. And it was always the intent of the sponsors of this legislation to have consequences for not sending those up. The legislative history is very clear that Congress was afraid that agencies were substituting these forms of guidance for notice and comment, and that there needed to be at least some way for Congress to get a handle of it. And one of the purposes of the Congressional Review Act was that they would at least begin to get a catalog of these kind of guidance documents, and the possibility that Congress could overrule them. So there's no serious question that all of these documents are covered. Well, the last thing I want to say is to invite everyone to join the website that Pacific Legal Foundation has put together, and we have some, our first, what I'm calling founding partner on the website is Club for Growth. David announced earlier this week that he is, and we have some invitations out to some other institutions that are respected for this website. And let me just mention a couple of features and ways that you all listening to the call can participate. But the website's address is redtaperollback.com. So that's redtaperollback.com. And if you have your cell phone, if you're listening on a podcast, you can also text rollback to 51555. So that's rollback at 51555. And it, when you go to the site, you'll see that we have a little bit of further information on these different ways to use the Congressional Review Act more effectively and aggressively. There's, you know, the sort of description of Congressional Review Act as it was traditionally intended if the agencies followed it. And then there's another section on Congressional Review Act, what I was termed 2.0 and 3.0. But even higher up on the homepage is that, is how you all can participate. There is a button that says find and report rules that were never submitted to Congress. What we have is a link to GAO's database of every rule that GAO has submitted to it. So if you know a rule that bedevils you, bedevils your clients, is killing America, especially if it's a policy manual, a guidance document that's being enforced against one of your clients, type the title into this GAO database and agency, and there's various ways that you can search it. If it was ever published in the Federal Register using the Federal Register page, my colleagues have found is most effective. And if you don't get a hit, that probably means it was not submitted to Congress and is subject and lawfully is never in effect and is lawfully should not be enforced. If that's the case, you take whatever legal action you want, but the second step we request is there is a response form on the website. And the response form invites you, asks you to send us the name of that rule and a short statement as to why you think it's bad and why you think either the administration should reinvestigate it or that you think it should be sent up to Congress and killed so that nothing substantially similar could ever be enacted again. So we hope that that is a specially valuable tool, and we know this particular audience is going to be one of our most valuable sources for careful identification of rules that weren't submitted to Congress and that also should be killed, because I think you all have the great real-world experience on why a particular rule or guidance document should be killed. We found at PLF that some of the guidance documents and rules we've been litigating against were never sent to Congress. So we're thinking about how we are going to try to either amend those complaints or bring new complaints so that we can not only try to get the administration and Congress to take advantage, but also engage the courts in using the law to overturn regulations that never followed the law and violated the law. So with that, I turn it back to Dean.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We've got a lot on the table. I'm going to open the floor to questions. First, let me say to Todd, I'm going to ask you to repeat the website. I think you might have caught some people off guard without pen and paper ready. So let me open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. If you'd like to visit the website, get a pen and paper ready. And Todd Gazziano, if you'd repeat how folks can access the website.
Two ways. redtaperollback.com. And I should also add, we've set up a Facebook page for Red Tape Rollback, and the Twitter is at Red Tape Rollback. They could also text just the word rollback at 51555.
Very good. Again, if you're in the audience, you've got a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me start things off here, if I could, by asking you, how does the Congressional Review Act define provided to, that in the context of, or provide to, in the context of the agencies must provide to Congress notice of the rule? And in addressing that question, explain to me, if you could, why publication in the Federal Register for a notice and comment or publication on a website for guidance, why won't the courts consider that to be constructive notice in any case that's brought later?
I'll answer the technical question, and then maybe David will want to say why publication wasn't sufficient, but there is a particular in the legislation or was it the legislative history? There's a particular office in the Capitol on the House side and the Senate side and GAO address where they deliver it, and I found really amusing going back over the legislative history and OMB knows how to do this. OMB is in the agencies, even in the independent agencies, know how to do this. But I was amused that if there was an emergency, the legislative history provided, said that they could send them by telefax. This is before email, I think, or at least before email was widely used. telefax to certain of these offices. And I'll let David talk about why publication, the many reasons why publication wasn't enough. But the other reason is that there are all these very important dates, and there was a compromised legislation as to the amount of time Congress could use these expedited procedures. By the way, it's 60 legislative days in the House, 60 session days in the Senate. That's the term the Senate used. And they had to be keyed to particular days. So it wouldn't work if an agency could say, well, we secretly published this on our website, and that's when, and your review period, Congress, has already expired because we secretly published it on our website 3 months ago. There had to be triggers to make at least the expedited procedure clocks operate in a predictable way.
And you're exactly right, Todd. That was the key reason. And Congress operates all the time on a very formal means of communication with the president and executive agencies. And so we wanted to make sure that delivery was specified so that formalism was met, so everybody in Congress could be aware of the exact date that it began, how much time do they have if they want to try to review and repeal that regulation in order to take advantage of those expedited procedures.
Very good. We do have one question pending, after which our lines will be wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Hi, it's David Troyan in Cleveland. Todd, you've been to Cleveland before to speak to our chapter here, and good to hear your voice again. So my question is about standing. So who would have standing to challenge these rules? Does Pacific Legal Foundation independently have standing, or taxpayers, or does it have to be somebody that's affected by the regulation? That would be one question. And second of all, wouldn't those affected be hesitant to challenge the agency on these grounds in the fear of retaliation?
The good question. There are different types of suit, though, so it would depend on the type of suit. One way that it could be raised is in a defense with a real client who's being negatively affected. I think that's the cleanest and the simplest. Some others have suggested to me some potential declaratory action. There is, I should add to the callers, partial judicial review bar. And it clearly bars judicial review of Congress's choice as to application of the expedited procedures, but probably OMB's major rule determinations, because major rules were held up in their effectiveness a little longer, the Congress didn't want there to be judicial review of those OMB determinations. There was legislative history to suggest that the courts would have to give effect to whether the rule was ever in effect, and that was just a purely legal determination. For example, if it was sort of undisputed that the agency, there was no evidence of it, undisputed that the agency had never sent it to Congress. The district courts are split on whether even that judicial review is available, but I think the most thorough interpretation of that in a district court that maybe it'll take me a minute to find, that's name escapes me, is that that has to be subject to judicial review, and the legislative history makes that a distinction. I am confident, PLF has won two Supreme Court cases now unanimously out of the past three, the Sackett and Hawks case, on judicial review. And I'm fairly much more confident that the Supreme Court, if it ever gets there, would rule that there is judicial review of whether the rule is in effect, particularly if it's raised as a defense in an enforcement action. And that's why I think we lost, PLF lost on numerous district courts and courts of appeal before Sackett, and then we won unanimously 9-0. We lost in certain circuit and district courts and circuit courts in the similar case under the APA that we won just last spring, and we won 8-0. So that's why I think there are interesting issues of judicial review, but it's, I'm glad you reminded me of one. Another way that it could come up is if the administration decides that it is going to reconsider one of these notice and comment rules that was never sent to Congress. There could be an environmental group that then sues the administration, and the administration would have various ways of trying to stop that, and standing would certainly be one of them.
Thank you.
We do have a couple more questions pending, so let's check in with our next caller.
Hi, this is Kim Crockett at Center of the American Experiment in Minnesota. And thank you so much. You guys are my heroes with the CRA. We stumbled on a rule that was issued by the Federal Transit Administration that expands regional bodies, metropolitan planning organizations. It was a midnight rule, went into effect in the Federal Register on January 19th, the day before the inauguration. I have done a little research, Todd and David, and the reports were sent to both the House and the Senate, and I have links to those. So this isn't one of the 2.0s. It seems to have followed the procedures in terms of delivering reports, but we're still under that 60-day look back, right? And this is still a superior tool. This is what I wanted you to address. It seems to me, one of our congressmen that I'm working with said, oh, we're going to have the president kill that. And I said, I think you want to use the CRA. And I'm doing my best to get them information on this. So could you speak to that, the use of the CRA versus, a rollback by the president?
Let me start, and then Todd can add more details about the way the law operates. But, yes, it is a superior tool, primarily because it's written into the legislation that when Congress kills a regulation using the CRA, the agency cannot issue a substantially similar regulation in the future until there's new legislative authority to do so. And so, therefore, if the Trump administration lasts 4 years and we get the Elizabeth Warren administration and they want to bring it back, they can if Trump's killed it. If the Congress has killed it with CRA, they can't bring it back until Congress passes new legislation.
I don't have much to add, but let me, except for one question, first to you, Kim.
Yes.
Was it a notice and comment rule?
Yes, I believe so. In fact, so many comments. Yes, there was public comments. So it was under Administrative Procedures Act or whatever it is.
Right. I thought it sounded like it was, and if it was and it was published in the Federal Register, then it was properly sent up to Congress, which means that it cannot be held up past the extended period of time that the effective date is automatically held up. It means that if Trump were to try to modify or repeal that, the administration would have to go through notice and comment rulemaking procedure, which I don't know why it often takes 2 to 10 years, but it often takes 2 to 10 years.
Right.
And so the other, with regard to that particular rule or any other rule that's a notice and comment rule, there is a huge advantage to the administration if Congress has 50 plus one votes in the Senate and a majority in the House to repeal it. The additional advantage is that Congress shares in the political responsibility and accountability that the CRA was designed to provide as well. but it's much, much quicker. The courts, again, haven't been asked to give any effect, but I've been really amused, besides that Washington Post article I talked about, but a few other articles I've seen from the left, and one famous comedian, Samantha Bee, went into a little tirade that, that this is awful that Congress should be able to pass an expeditious law, a law, and it's terrible that that by law they can overrule these bureaucrats. But as funny as it sounds to us, no court really is going to, Samantha Bee can question this, but no one else is going to question the effectiveness of a law. You know, even if the administration goes through this 2 to 10 year period to repeal the rule and it's successful, then it could go back up on to the D.C. Circuit, which I hope is changed by then. And someone could say, oh, you didn't really have a good reason to repeal or modify that rule. But if Congress passes a law, that's it.
I want to make sure we do have one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I think I've got this straight now about the congressional authorization. That is, no substantially similar rule, once stricken by Congress, can be passed without additional congressional authorization. I want to make sure that means a subsequent congressional act. So, for example, if there's a rule out there on acid rain, it's passed under the Clean Air Act, under the Congressional Review Act, it's stricken, but there's an existing Clean Water Act, and the agency then purports to go back and pass a substantially similar acid rain regulation based on the Clean Water Act, because after all, the rain is coming down and getting in the water. Does it have to be a subsequent congressional statute to constitute? Okay, good. That's a long-winded question and a good short answer. Thank you, Todd. Still one question pending. Let's take another call.
Hey, Dean, before let me mention one thing related to Kim's question. In her case, it was a rule that was promulgated with notice and comment. If it had been a guidance document, which the Obama administration increasingly used to regulate without having to do notice and comment, it's also a superior, the same reason makes it a superior tool to use the CRA, because then the agency can't, if you simply withdraw the guidance, it's gone, that's good, but they could easily bring it back at some future time. So this would put a bar on them trying to use guidance to accomplish the same thing sometime in the future.
Right. I think I've opened the line for the next caller. If you have a question, go right ahead.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. It's David Emerson with the Berkeley Federal Society chapter. Yeah, thanks, gentlemen, for your great efforts here. You know, I've got a question. It's not on the CRA or on notice and comment, but I'm hoping it's at least germane to the conversation about regulation and excess regulation and effective regulation. The question has to do with the types of cost-benefit analysis that is often baked into the justification for types of regulations, and how, in hindsight, these cost-benefit analyses often greatly underestimate the cost and overestimate the benefits, so that the result is nowhere near in the ballpark of what was originally sold as a bill of goods to Congress. So my question has to do with whether or not, at least as a, you know, looking at this as a sort of a failure of condition subsequent, whether there are any grounds that you can envision where legislation that is passed on one set of assumptions where reality is quite a bit different could be subject to some kind of collateral attack.
Well, I'll just say that there are other laws that govern the type of data that should be used. And I know there are a lot of other reform bills that are designed to improve the situation that you described. But in many, I'm not sure, other than some of the broader and harder to win APA challenges, can you collaterally attack just bad science?
There are, speaking of reform efforts, there has been discussion that I've heard of, this is Dean, about third-party cost-benefit analysis, that is, turning that over to a disinterested party somewhere else in the government. Also, some discussion of cost-benefit analysis look-back, so that if there's a regulation that passes based on cost-benefit analysis 5-10 years down the road, that third party takes another look and makes sure that the expectation comports with reality. Our lines are now wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me ask you another question, and that's about any pushback you're getting. Beyond, is it Samantha B? Samantha B, whatever her name was. Beyond her, is there some serious legal argument going on here? You've laid out a great case between the two of you, great reasons why this should work. Are there scholars assembling on the other side making contrary arguments? And let me just put one forward, and that's that,
sure,
you know, if groups like PLF and other litigating groups have challenged a regulation, there some of these regulations are up to 21 years old, back to the passage of the CRA. We've all assumed the world is operating as if they're legitimate. Is a court going to uphold the overturning of a regulation that has been challenged on various grounds? This challenge has never been brought before. Everyone's assumed, even the regulated communities, assumed it's been effective. Is there a latches or sort of reliance argument here that other side will make?
David, do you want me to try to go first?
Yeah, please do. Intuitively, it's a really good question.
Yeah, oh, it certainly is. First of all, you reminded me I was remiss in not recommending Paul Larkin's paper for Heritage, The Reach of the Congressional Review Act, which I think is a very detailed and almost definitive paper that came out in the last few weeks since we've been discussing what I call Congressional Review 2.0 that establishes the validity of that. And I'm aware of no legal scholar, and this is what's interesting me, who has questioned Congress's authority to use the expedited procedure if a rule that was never delivered is now delivered to it. And I want your listeners to just think about this for a minute. As long as the Senate properly applies the Congressional Review Act, and there's three different ways you get to the same conclusion that the clock can't begin to start until the rule is delivered. If the Senate applies the expedited procedures and there is a final vote, and both houses vote to disapprove and it's sent to the president and signed into law, there is no court that will second guess the interpretation of the House and Senate's procedures. There's an independent constitutional clause that gives the House and Senate power to make their own rules and interpret their own rules as long as they don't violate another constitutional provision. And the CRA, if anything, just modifies existing House rules. So I think that part of the equation is the legal question is almost without a doubt, serious doubt anyway, and I've not seen any. I have tried to be very honest about where there are open legal questions. There are the meaning of substantially similar once these rules are struck down has not been taken up by the court, and I've suggested some areas where I think courts could find guidance, and Congress can provide guidance in the debates. I think there is this question that is interesting, but maybe not that important, affect that many rules in what I call CRA 3.0, and that's the administration just deciding never to send it up to Congress, but to either withdraw it or reconsider it. And I think that may be the most open, but it depends on how that issue comes up. For example, if we are defending a client who is having a rule enforced against him or her that was not lawfully issued, I think the argument suggested by others is that we have an APA challenge, and that may or may not be subject to one level of judicial review. But we also have a due process claim, and the due process claim is there can't be due process of law against our client when there was no law, when the regulation is not lawful. And I think that is a powerful argument, regardless of the fact that other industries were relying on that rule and implemented it. You know, as to my client, who is being wrongly either prosecuted or wrongly have an enforcement action against him, as let's say we represent a farmer and EPA is unlawfully in trying to enforce one of these guidance on, and this is a real world situation. The idea that other people have already relied on this awful illegal rule, I don't think is very persuasive, but I'm sure that we can find some judges who would go there. The real question in my mind is what the 8, soon to be 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court would say about that.
David McIntosh, anything on this point?
No, I think Todd covered it all.
Okay. Well, we've got just a couple minutes left. Let me go turn back to each of you and give you a chance to express any final thoughts you have. Actually, we do have one more question pending, so let's see if we can get this in quickly. Go right ahead, caller.
This is Kim Crockett again in Minnesota. So, question for you, David, in particular. We want to get this MPO rule walked back under the CRA, and if you're in Congress and you're getting these requests and there is a clock ticking, what can you have you heard if anyone in Congress is sort of taking the lead on taking care of all these things, or is it one off? I mean, what's the best strategy once I convince our congressional delegation that it's not the president we want to work with, it's them?
So the best person who's championing this so far is Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader in the House, who's made it a high priority for them. I am pretty sure he's relying on the committee staffs to sort through which ones to bring forward. So start with your Minnesota delegation, but then try to reach out as well to the staff and the members on the relevant committee that has oversight over the agency. And then I'd let Kevin's office know also. They may send you somewhere else, but frankly, it's good for him to get that feedback that people are paying attention and here's an idea and thank you for doing it.
Right. Well, I am working with Congressman Jason Lewis, a staff member on transportation, and I've got this in front of them and our analysis, which based on today, I think was right. I was a little nervous to send it to them before talking to you, but great. Because, you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of things to clean up, especially the midnight rules, and why not just do it as a group, given how busy everybody is?
Yeah, the House could easily do that. The Senate has decided they have to bring them up one at a time, but they're also waiting for the House to act. So get it to them, get it started there, and then we can move over to the Senate side. Also, put it on Todd's website so everybody can see it and contribute too.
Looks like we've got 1 minute. We do have one final question. Let's see if we can squeeze this in before the midnight hour here.
Hi, this is Kendra Rotunda. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be quick. So I'm out in California, and I do military and veterans law. And we encounter a lot of, you know, what you've described, where there are rules promulgated, we think illegally, frankly, in various handbooks and guidance that the agency publishes, much of which has not gone through notice and comment. So that's sort of one issue. And the other issue with the Congressional Review Act, I'm just wondering if you have looked at some of these VA rules and especially the recent look-back provision that would limit compensation and pension for veterans who need aid and attendance. The VA just went through the notice and comment period on that one. It hasn't yet been finalized, But I'm wondering if that's on your radar, or if any of the VA issues are on your radar yet, because I think there could be pretty fertile ground here.
Who wants to take that?
I'm not familiar with that. Todd, have you heard anything? But
not much. Good to hear from you, Kendra. Kendra, this is why we need you and others on listening to the podcast and the call to send us your information. We would love to have our list when we go. We don't yet have the list on the website. We just have the search database. But when we go put that on, we would like it to be as representative and complete as possible to show the public, to show the press, and to show any policymaker the vast number of they are illegal. They may be illegal for other reasons, but they're also illegal if they're being enforced and they weren't sent to Congress.
Well, gentlemen, we are out of time. I want to thank you both on behalf of the Federalist Society, Congressman David McIntosh, Todd Gazziano. Thank you both. This has been very enlightening. Thanks to the audience as well for dialing in for your thoughtful questions. Please check the Federalist Society's website and monitor your emails for upcoming teleforum conference calls. We've got a full slate next week, but until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.